Hello and welcome to New Netherland Praatjes, a series of chats on the Dutch colony of New Netherland, brought to you by the New Netherland Institute and the New Netherland Research Center in Albany, New York. Praatjes is Dutch for chat, and these are informal conversations with historians, archaeologists, and other experts on the world of the 17th century Dutch.
Hello, everyone. I am Steve Mackerlane of the New Netherland Institute, and welcome to the December 2018 edition of New Netherland Praatjes, episode number 14. For this interview, I was joined by Dr. Joyce Goodfriend. Joyce is professor of history at the University of Denver. In addition to numerous other works, she is the author of Before the Melting Pot, Society and Culture in Colonial New York City, 1664 to 1730. Editor of Revisiting New Netherland, Perspectives on Early Dutch America, and co-editor of Going Dutch, The Dutch Presence in America, 1609 to 2009. Her latest book, Who Should Rule at Home? Confronting the Elite in British New York City, was the winner of the 2016 Dixon Ryan Fox Manuscript Prize awarded by the New York State Historical Association. So, as I mentioned in the interview, Joyce's name comes up often in New Netherland studies for her work on the Dutch presence in early New York, her essays on the field of New Netherland studies, and as editor of the two New Netherland-centered collections I mentioned above. In this interview, you'll see her wide range of knowledge and passion for early American scholarship as we cover topics like the evolution of New Netherland studies, Anglicization, and this really fascinating dynamic or dynamics of cultural authority in early New York, something that for years historians really didn't notice, I guess you could say, as they focused on more formal structures of power, and also the role of language and religion in the perseverance of so-called Dutchness. And finally, Joyce's musings on possible future paths for New Netherland studies are a fitting end to an enlightening conversation. As always, I welcome your comments and suggestions at nni@newnetherlandinstitute.org. Joyce, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
You're welcome. Okay, so I'd like to start off with one question I have always had, and whenever I read New Netherland being kind of a niche topic or esoteric topic, I always wonder how someone came into the field. As we were talking before, how I came into the field was I was working in a library and I ended up scanning New Netherland documents, and then the rest is history, of course. So tell me, how did you come into your interest in New Netherland?
I guess the best way to put it is that I backed into it. I started as a student of very early British New York as I was preparing my dissertation, and found a bunch of Dutch people all over the place in New York City, which had, of course, been New Amsterdam. So there was no way that I could write my dissertation or my subsequent book, Before the Melting Pot, without pushing back and establishing a sort of baseline of New York society, which of course had been New Amsterdam society. And the more I pushed, the less I found in terms of recent good scholarship on these Dutch settlers of early Manhattan, essentially. And I was working mostly on the city. So it just sort of happened. It wasn't that I started with an agenda, I'm going to study the Dutch. But as time went on, I realized the Dutch were a critical part of New York City and more generally New York colony history.
Now you aren't from the New York area, are you?
I was born on Manhattan.
Oh, okay.
I haven't lived there in a long, long time, okay. But I grew up in Manhattan and suburban New York, and went to school in New England and then in California, and then went off to Denver to teach.
So growing up on Manhattan, what was your idea of New Amsterdam, of the Dutch?
Probably very stereotypical
in terms of
there were places named Stuyvesant whatnot. But I was totally uninformed about the Dutch presence in any serious way.
Now,
and that's probably true of a majority of people who grow up in Manhattan.
Yeah, and now, of course, people know more, but still, it's still, I mean, generally, people don't know much about 400 years ago anyway.
No, that's probably true.
Yeah. So now that The period that you're doing, I've thought about how New Netherland was always known as this kind of forgotten colony, but after, you know, these decades of Charlie Gehring and Jannie Venema working on these translations, it's risen to prominence with attention from the Dutch government, et cetera. Now, it seems that that period you're working on has become the really obscure period, this 1664 to, say, French Indian War or Revolution, because for me, American history, in school we learn about maybe beginning with the French Indian War period, and that
leading up to the American Revolution,
because everything is, of course, a prelude to the Revolution, and it's hard to find such a thing in 1680. So
right,
I think that
right,
that's
right. Yeah.
So when you started research, what had been done about that period? Roy Ritchie had
written a. He was actually a fellow doctoral student at UCLA with me, but he was quite a bit ahead of me. And he published this book called The Duke's Province. Can't remember the exact subtitle. And that became kind of a standard work. But it was not people-centered. It was centered more on legislation and formal changes of government. It was quite authoritative. There's nothing wrong with that book at all, and it provided a framework. But I'm always been a sort of a person who's interested in social experience and cultural values, and I thought there was a lot more to explore, and I wanted to do the microcosm of the city rather than the entire colony. So that was sort of what was in my mind, and I didn't have a pre-existing agenda in terms of here's exactly what I want to find, because there was no roadmap in terms of scholarship that had been done, except for very specialized studies of this or that. Yeah. But
so basically, what was your argument in Before the Melting Pot?
Before the Melting Pot, I think I was largely trying to just establish the continuity within New York, what became called New York City, was New Amsterdam, New Orange, New York City. I was trying to say, there's still a heck of a lot of Dutch people here, and they're having families, and they're going into the third generation. You remember I took a generational approach in that book. I guess that would lead into sort of the second sort of driving impetus, which was to challenge the so-called Anglicization thesis, which was out there. There was another book about early New York by a guy named Thomas Archdeacon. I think it was probably just called New York City with some dates. And that book really stressed the fact that the Dutch just disappeared from the scene really rapidly when the English appeared. And so I was engaged in an argument with that book in terms of saying the Dutch did not disappear. They may have lost power, sort of political recognition, but socially and culturally they were there, their families were there, their church was there, their language was still being spoken. So that was essentially my argument.
Okay, and it's still, we're going to talk more about it later, but your most recent book, Who Should Rule at Home, is still fighting that battle, right?
The most recent book is sort of based on my recognition that the story didn't end in 1730, which I thought it did when I wrote Before the Melting Pot, which I think is still a very good study of the earlier period in much greater detail than I go into in Who Should Rule at Home. But further research, I guess you might say,
okay.
Further research revealed to me that the Dutch presence was not gone by any means by 1730, which was the terminal date of Before the Melting Pot. And my argument in Who Should Rule at Home is that it extends essentially up to the revolutionary period. And in ways that are not visible in an obvious way, but the Dutch presence is still very significant in New York City history, British New York City history.
I've been around New Netherland studies, whatever, the world of New Netherland for maybe 8 years now. And one of the first things I noticed was your name pops up probably more than any choice. So, but and you like to talk about, I guess, the state of the field, why New Netherland matters. So in 1999, you wrote this article, Writing/Writing, Dutch colonial history, which was a kind of a survey of the field, a historiographical.
And a really field. Clever title.
Yes.
It was dealing with a wonderful gentleman, Wendell Tripp, who at the time was the editor of New York History. And I submitted the article and I sort of tentatively said, well, how about this title? And he said, yes, it's good. Let's do it. So I thought it was a good way to suggest we should produce more scholarship. Yep. But also to change the perspective and say the Dutch, not only in New York City, but all over the colony, have not been given their due.
And speaking of titles, I just realized that you wrote another article called Present at the Creation, which was a play on something else, correct?
Yeah, I can't even recall. It was a phrase that was borrowed
from somebody in the CIA, not the CIA.
I think it was some political figure. That deals with the memory of the Dutch.
So you've dealt with in your career this early New York period with the Dutch at the center. And the English and the French.
Yeah, it's a tripartite, really. Yeah. I mean, even in the latest book, the French, the Huguenots who come to New York are significant in sort of tipping the balance against the Dutch. That was an argument that I sort of arrived at much, much later than before the melting pot, just when I was doing this new book, that the French were critical because they politically largely aligned with the English against the Dutch.
So let's go back to that article, that writing Dutch colonial history. As you wrote, quote, rehabilitating the colonial Dutch involves stripping away the layers of misinformation and misrepresentation that still endure and returning to the original sources for evidence. The multiplication of books, articles, and dissertations on various aspects of the Dutch colonial experience in the mid-Atlantic region in the last decade and a half, remember, this was written in 1999, demonstrates not only that increasing numbers of historians are convinced of the necessity of this task, but also that colonial Dutch studies has become a vital field of research in the United States, unquote. And you give a few reasons for this, one of them being the translations done by Charlie Gagnani.
I mean, that's fundamental. I mean, without those translations, a lot of scholarship would not have been done.
Certainly,
I think. I mean, obviously, there's some people who read 17th century Dutch in manuscript, and more power to them. But I think the translations, just the mere fact of their availability to non-professional linguistic people, is enormously important.
And one of the things that I always point out when people will say, "Well, some people read the documents," I think we all know for sure that even people who do read the documents have that translation on their shelf that they could flip right through, which makes it so much more accessible.
Why not?
Of course, why not? It's a finding aid at least.
Yeah, no, I mean, Charlie and Yanni's translations are just definitive, really, I think.
So you gave the translations and you gave work done by Dutch scholars like Wim Klooster. So these Dutch scholars coming in kind of... not legitimized, but it brought it. Cause I remember when we did the first one we did in this series was Charlie, and he was saying how when he began, the Dutch scholars didn't really care. There were a few people interested for linguistic reasons, but the Dutch weren't. And this is in the mid 1970s. So you're saying that they became and Wim, who was still a leading scholar in the field. In the 90s, they became more of a presence in the field?
I was actually, and I'm not sure how far Wim was along in his work at this time when
he had published a book, which you mentioned, which I don't remember the name.
Well, whatever. I was invited to give a sort of keynote address at a conference in the Netherlands, and I think it was 1995.
Okay.
So there were other people involved, So to me, that represented the emergence of a transatlantic interest in New Netherland. And I probably met Jaap Jacobs somewhere in that time frame. I can't pin down the exact chronology. But it became apparent that there were people on both sides of the Atlantic that were interested in New Netherland. I mean, scholarship in the Netherlands and the early colonial experience had centered for decades, if not centuries, on the Dutch East Indies.
Okay.
And the Dutch West Indies were sort of late on the scene in terms of a sort of significant scholarly inquiry. And that started to happen in the 1990s. And it may be for reasons that I didn't mention in the article with respect to developments in the Netherlands. Okay. But there sort of was a meeting of the minds.
The third reason that you mentioned was Atlantic history, which of yeah. course is a big part of New Netherland no longer became this isolated kind of a lot of people see it as, well, it was just a failed venture of the West India Company. Right. It became part of an Atlantic of the Atlantic world, which yeah. really made it more relevant.
Absolutely.
In scholarship.
And, yeah. I think another sort of a corollary of that would be, at least to some extent, the sort of waning of the infatuation with everything English settlers okay. did. When I started graduate school way back, everybody was studying either Puritans or Quakers or the Virginians. That's why New York being essentially multicultural from the beginning, although the term is a modern term, was not really addressed until some of us started in late 60s, early 70s to say, there's another whole aspect to early America.
Yeah.
Present at the creation. Yeah, a lot of Dutch. And then of course, the Germans. So there was work on Pennsylvania and was like, oh, English people didn't have a monopoly on early American history.
And why do you think that was? I know that many people have said that many of the prominent colleges and universities were in New England and they kind of set the agenda. Is that accurate, you think?
I went to one of those okay. prominent colleges, Brown University, okay. and never heard one word about the Dutch, yep. that's for sure. I think the 60s and the emergence of African American history and ethnic history and Native American history and even the beginnings of women's history sort of shattered that sort of consensus version of history that had dominated through the 1950s of, you know, virtuous Puritans and all of that stuff. And that it sort of created an opening to do a more inclusive type of approach to early America. And that then New York is like, of course, New York is the perfect case study of all of that.
It is something that a place like New York was neglected for so long.
It was.
Historically. And even if you, I remember I was, I think I was in a gas station and I heard this commercial on the radio and it said, see the history of Boston and the excitement of New York, as if New York didn't have a history.
Yeah.
It was around just pretty much as long.
Well, I think New Englanders have been obsessed with their history for centuries, and because they think they produce such an amazing record of yeah. Puritan sermons and literature, and then as you even get in the 19th century, all the great writers, Hawthorne and Emerson and so on, and New York, what do? They just make money.
Yeah. Yep.
And so that was, I wrote this article in, I think in 1989 in the William and Mary Quarterly, where it's talking about religion in early New York City and trying to disprove this legacy that religion almost didn't exist in New York City, that studying churches and people's religious practices was ridiculous. Because New Yorkers were so secular from the beginning, which is totally untrue. It's untrue in New Netherland, and it's untrue in early New York. And both of my major books have shown in detail that religious practice is very worthy of study.
Yeah, well, I remember, well, it was before my time, but I saw the evidence of it. I think it must have been PBS or whoever came out with a documentary about New Netherland, and it was just this kind of just ridiculous caricature of, they didn't build a church for how many years? They were all about making money. I remember Firth Fabian wrote a letter saying how ridiculous that is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
this idea of just, New York is about making money. But one thing that, it does seem true that the literary output of New England was much higher.
Absolutely.
Right. So that was probably, obviously it makes it a lot easier to study history
when you have all that that literature to study. Yeah.
New England culture was in the driver's seat in the mid-19th century, and with the victory of the North in the Civil War over the South, New Englanders really were controlling what today we might call the media to a very significant extent. And so what they wrote, not only in the most famous books, but in, you know, monthly magazines and all of that stuff, was very slanted.
Yeah, there's an interesting book on this kind of making of New Netherland called Imagining New, of New England, called Imagining New England by Joseph Conforti.
Oh yeah,
if anybody wants
to read that, that's a very good book.
Yeah,
it is an excellent book.
So you're writing Dutch colonial history article was in 1899. And then you wrote Why New Netherland Matters for this compilation of essays in 2009. So what did you see change, just generally, over those 10 years?
Well, there was more scholarship on New Netherland. And I think it was still necessary, however, to make the argument that in the big picture of early America, one needed to recognize that the Dutch were a significant presence, not necessarily because they held political power, but as I argue in several different publications, the Dutchness was a cultural reality. And if we got in a time capsule and went back a few hundred years, we would just be immersed in a Dutch tinctured society without any kind of reputation in sort of official literature. If you just walked the streets, you would just hear Dutch. This is about when, and I can't remember the exact chronology, I became really interested in the fact that worship in the Dutch Reformed Church in New York continued in the Dutch language until 1764. And that was like an entire century after the English first sailed into New York Harbor. And I gave lots of papers and talks and all of this stuff about it. But it just struck me, how could that be if the Anglicization thesis was correct?
Yeah, and
it didn't make any sense. And so I wrote, did a lot of research and a lot of writing about that seemingly anomalous fact. And discovered a huge internecine battle within the Dutch Reformed Church over bringing just one preacher to preach in English. They didn't get rid of the Dutch preacher. It wasn't like either or. Most people say, well, oh, they switched totally to English. They didn't. They had two Dutch language preachers. But then they brought Archibald Laidley, who was actually a Scotsman who had lived a bit and preached in the Netherlands. And they brought him, and he was the English preacher. He was also an evangelical, and he proved enormously popular. Then they brought John Henry Livingston, and so there were two Dutch preachers and two English language preachers. But that didn't take place till the 1760s, but I think they've been fighting about it for at least three decades. Language, which, why would anybody do that unless the Dutch cultural presence was still vital?
Yeah, and one of the things that really surprised me was that the Constitution was translated into Dutch. I think they say it was mostly for, was it for Albany? Because Albany,
I think it was for people in the Upper Hudson Valley, especially Albany, because there were people probably fourth, fifth generation in the Albany area who still didn't have a perfect command of English.
That's remarkable.
Language is not just a sort of a technical device. Language shapes the way you think about the world, your cosmology, your sense of meaning of things, the proper place and order of things. And if you're thinking about the world through a Dutch vocabulary and Dutch quotations and images, that doesn't go away the next day if an English guy comes and takes over the pulpit. I mean, that just went on for a long time, that sort of Dutch view of the world.
Yeah, and not just and not just Dutch, but a Dutch that I assume that was kind of an antiquated form of
not
Dutch.
Not quite a pretty Dutch. Yeah, not a polite Dutch. And there are people like, I think it's William Livingston who said, oh, what kind of awful version of Dutch are you? And then some of the ministers that would come. But an important part of my new book, I would say, and this is based on an earlier conference paper, an essay, was exposing the fact that in New York they were still importing and selling Dutch language books up to essentially the revolution. Now, obviously, there was a kind of what you would say a niche market for that. Not everybody is going to be able to read, even if you are of Dutch ancestry. You know, the younger people probably are like, what's that? But they were still able to market and sell Dutch language publications, which I thought was phenomenally interesting.
Yeah, you had a long list of
because it's money based. I mean, if you're a bookseller, you say, "Oh yeah, I'm proud of my Dutch heritage." Blah 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 blah. But if you're not going to make money, you're not going to put that on your list. That they're advertised with titles in the newspapers, like "Here's available all these Dutch language books." Somebody's going to buy that, and so there were lots of people who still were familiar with the Dutch language on the eve of the American Revolution. That's astonishing, I think.
Yeah, and part of the reason why I mentioned the Albany connection was in your book you mentioned that you think that part of the reason why it persisted in a place like New York City was because it was occasionally fed from more rural areas.
Sure, so there's Dutch in migration.
Would come
in.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say there's several reasons, but certainly...
That was one.
Certainly there... Everybody knows there's not much migration from the Netherlands after the 1670s. So, I mean, occasional person shows up, but it's not like there are tons of Dutch immigrants to early British New York. However, there is a lot of circulation of members of existing families in New York, various parts, what's now Brooklyn, filled with Dutch farmers, the Hudson Valley filled with Dutch guys and gals. And northern New Jersey, lots of Dutch speakers there. And then sometimes members of the younger generation say, well, I'm going to the big city, or they marry somebody. So there's a lot of, I would call, rotation or circulation, and that could have infused something into the Dutch language. Also going to church. Until 1764, all you ever heard at the Dutch church was Dutch language sermons. Doesn't mean you understood everything, but you were just listening to the Dutch words, and it's just sort of there.
Now, were these sermons, and what language were they using? Was this an unchanged language over the entire time, or were these readings, etc., were they updated over time?
Do you mean the sermons given in the church?
In the Dutch language, was it were they evolving, or was it kind of a?
You mean in terms of language?
In terms of the actual words they used, yeah.
I suspect the sermons are in a kind of formal Dutch all the way along, because the ministers are highly educated, and even the ministers that appear in the 18th century, most of them come from the Netherlands.
Okay.
So I would say there's not, although I have not read all, heavens, I have not, well, most of them don't even exist anymore.
Yeah.
But I suspect it's a formal kind of educated Dutch that the preachers would use.
Okay, so we've touched on your latest book a lot. Let's take a step back and kind of really talk about that book. It's called, again, Who Should Rule at Home? Confronting the Elite in British New York City. And that title was borrowed from Carl Becker, a famous Carl Becker quote from beginning of the 20th century.
I think about 1909.
A
book called, I think it was A History of Political Parties in Colonial New York or something like that. It's an ancient work, but still has lots of value.
You hear that often, that quote.
But the funny part is I didn't start on my project, which I worked on for years before I finally got the book published, I didn't start with that title at all. The title happened when we were looking to improve a working title, which was pretty dull.
Okay.
It struck me as if that phrase covered what I was talking about in the book, which is cultural authority. Even though Becker himself would not have conceptualized the problem that way, his book, and it's a brilliant book. It still stands up. People read it. It's focused on formal politics, and then scholarship on British New York City. Pat Bonomy's work, of course, is standard. A factious people. As much insight as that gives into the history of New York in the British period, essentially, that's pretty much focused on formal politics as well. So what I wanted to probe was beneath the surface, what's going on in terms of authority within families, churches, communities.
And this leads into something else that I think is very interesting, especially to non-historians, is I'll often get, or maybe a few times, I'll get a question that is, how could people still be writing books about, say, George Washington? Like, haven't we said everything that needs to be said about George Washington? And I think that what you were just talking about and what you say in your introduction gets at how we could tell a different story with essentially the same facts, if you will, or the same set of documents. And as you say in the introduction to Who Should Rule at Home, that the previous literature, quote, falls short of offering a history of domination and subordination in the city that moves beyond the formal structures of power to consider what has been called the, quote, micro-sociology of power, which is a term that you borrowed from two British historians. So by changing the lens, and as you say here, another quote, from this perspective, the minutiae of negotiations on mundane matters take on weight in determining the efficacy of cultural authority. So these mundane matters all of a sudden become the focus of a book where without this change in focus, they would be, well, they'd be mundane. They'd be unimportant.
It's interesting because if you got in your time capsule and you went back 100, 125 years, you would find a series of books which we now call antiquarian history, which talk about customs and decorative arts and architecture, and they were written about many colonies in New York as well by people like Alice Morse Earle and Esther Singleton. That was sort of, I think, the ladies' side of history. So it wasn't formal politics or serious issues. It was what kinds of clothes were worn, what did people eat, what did their houses look like? What was their recreation? So people were interested in that, but there was no argument or framework with which to explain that these things were actually important. So I fixated. I mean, I had come to this with some of the earlier essays, this term cultural reality and then cultural authority. So essentially, cultural authority is the power, usually, of members of an elite or a set of elites to tell you what to think and how to behave. And it's not very easy to challenge the power of a member of the elite, because that might be the guy who employs you or holds the lease on your farm or is an important guy in the church and might prevent you from getting married there, or all sorts of other powers which are never really discussed in literature on political alignments and parties and quarrels. And so I came to realize that a lot of the work I had been doing sort of piecemeal, not only on the Dutch, but on women, on enslaved Africans, and on poor people, fit into a matrix in which the battles, not formal battles, not guys running around in the street with shotguns, but just sort of interactions and challenges, even just verbal challenges, were significant in terms of explaining what people actually held in terms of values.
And as you say in the book, the quote, submerged alternative discourses that lay behind the actions of individuals far from the levers of power.
Yeah, I mean, that's scholarly language for saying ordinary people, even though they are often forced to keep quiet, do have a vision of the world. And at certain times, under certain circumstances, they will become so frustrated or so inspired, and often a religious guy would come along and inspire people to say, no, I'm going to change my church. At those moments, you see hints of this buried discourse, which if you actually sat down and talked to them and say, well, what do you actually think about this? They would probably say, well, here's what I think. And it's not the same as the gentleman who sort of holds the reins of power over me. So what I was trying to do is to excavate at least enough of this buried discourse, which is, again, a fancy term, but just sort of to get into the minds of people who had very little power.
Let's talk about the content of the book itself. So in the first chapter, the kind of, I don't know if you want to call it the lever or the pivot, whatever, in this chapter was Lazarus' rebellion.
Okay.
Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, well, the first chapter was about the initial decades of British rule and the fact that it was never quite fixed where cultural power lay because of the Dutch reconquest in 1674 and Leisler's rebellion. So I was arguing for a good deal of discontinuity, whereas the Anglicization scholars would say, oh, yeah, the English came and everything became English. But it was very, very uncertain as to who was on first, essentially. Okay. And Leisler's Rebellion, of course, is a pivotal event. And I think more significantly for my purpose and maybe for your interest as well in memory is how the story of Leisler's Rebellion came to be written
exactly.
in the terms of the Anglophiles.
Talk about that a little bit.
Just
give a brief description of what Lazarus' Rebellion was.
Lazarus' Rebellion is in response to the Glorious Revolution in England, and it's led by a very fervent Protestant named Jacob Leisler, who was already a settler in New Amsterdam, so he's been in New York for quite a while, and who developed a powerful critique of the British leaders of New York, the British officials, as being essentially Catholic. So there's an enormous religious conflict between Protestant and Catholics. Of course, a glorious revolution in England is about displacing James II, who has recently come to the throne because he's a Catholic, and his wife has just given birth to a son who will eventually become the pretender.
That was 1689?
Yeah, around there, and 1688, I think, and leads into 1689. And that's when William and Mary are brought to the throne, William being a Dutch guy.
So
that sort of inspired some of the Dutch in New York that, well, now we're going to be real Protestants. And so David Voorhees has argued this for years and has done an enormous amount to, I mean, if you want to know about Leisler, you've got to interview David.
Yep.
Leisler's Rebellion, I was convinced by David's scholarship as essentially a religious focus. But the English, as they come to write the story after it's over and Leisler and his associate Milbourne are executed publicly, which is like a tremendous spectacle, the English write the story as if it's an ethnic story. And as you read in that, as I worked on that a long time, not only about the continuity issue, but about creating Leisler as an ethnic villain and more generally the Dutch as buffoons and ignoramuses and stuff like that. There have been a lot of interpretations over time of Leisler's Rebellion. I mean, some guy wrote way back when a class conflict interpretation.
Of course.
But I think at heart it's a religious or probably an ethno-religious conflict. And there were English on the side of Leisler as well. It wasn't just Dutch guys.
And one of the things that makes, you know, all this stuff so complicated is that you have the Dutch, you have the English, but of course it's not that simple.
No, we got the French too.
And the one, the French.
That's where the French start exerting a little leverage. And then, for that moment, the French are sort of have power is transitional. There's a transitional period by the 1720s. There's no real French power at all.
And it, even within the Dutch, English, and French, you of course have I don't know if you want to call them factions, but different.
Divisions among the Dutch, certainly.
Then you have to have a
kind of growing separation between a Dutch elite, which sees the handwriting on the wall and does actually anglicize to a great extent, and then I would say the majority of Dutch people who are not totally convinced that's the way to go. But the majority of Dutch by the early 18th century, after the sort of resonance of Leisler's rebellion for a couple of decades, and then that goes away by the 1710s. And then the Dutch are off the political stage as a coalition. The Dutch power becomes culturally centered in the church and in the language and in families. Okay, there are no Dutch politicians by the 1720s, 30s. It's no longer a Dutch interest.
So how did they wield that cultural power, and what did it get them? Was it powerful overall?
No. So the majority of Dutch, I would say, sort of working people, middling and lower Dutch people, and this lower in the social structure, they're just there. They don't claim either political power or cultural authority over English or French people. That's impossible. They can't do that. So I think it's just perseverance, just going on and speaking Dutch at home, going to worship at the Dutch church, practicing Dutch customs in their families, congregating in neighbor, what we would today call ethnic neighborhoods, just surviving. Surviving is heroism sometimes, certainly in other contexts in history. Surviving, reading imported Dutch books, and staying Dutch. Now, and that doesn't mean that they didn't adapt to at least to some extent in terms of learning English. I've argued in a couple of places that you could be bilingual. It was okay. You don't have to be either or. Either you're Dutch or you're English. I think as you get through the generations, you get more and more Dutch, even at the lower ends of the social spectrum, who are at least minimally bilingual, because, man, it's an English city. That's okay, but their heart is still with their Dutch roots. So the Dutch are not a political power or a cultural power that's aiming to convert the French or the English or the Germans to being Dutch. That's gone. That's impossible. But just maintaining their presence, I think, is the significant part.
What were some of the ways that the Dutch anglicized? Let's say the elite Dutch in the earlier days. I mean, some of them changed their names to an anglicized version, right?
Not really.
No? Okay.
I don't see, off the top of my head, I don't see much evidence of that. Okay. One thing I point out in several publications is that certain Dutch families, I think I gave an example of the Van Horn family, they send their children to schools to learn good English. Even the De Peisters do that even earlier. So the next generation, particularly the boys, but girls as well, they're brought up speaking English. Doesn't mean they totally forget their Dutch. So the handwriting is on the wall. If you're going to succeed in British New York, you've got to be fluent in English. Some of them change their church membership. Some become Presbyterian, some become Anglican. That would be another way that they anglicize. Certainly in terms of maintaining their wealth, and I have not investigated this. There's probably other scholars who have. They start making deals with English merchants. I have never really investigated the economic history per se, but there are books on it. And I think it would show that if you want to maintain your place at the top of the mercantile hierarchy, you don't just deal with other Dutch guys. Become con- I actually that sort of raises the theme that I mentioned in the book. The members of the elite, and I call it a pan-ethnic elite. In New York's elite is comprised of people of Dutch heritage, English heritage, French heritage, even a few Jewish people. These are the people with wealth and influence. They become cosmopolitan in their outlook, whereas the large numbers of people who continue to speak Dutch, at least for part of the day, they're kind of provincial in their outlook. They're looking inward. And one aspect of the elite, it's sort of like people with a global outlook today. If you're a member of the elite, you're well aware of the Atlantic world and trading patterns and how to make money and shipping and all. And you have no problem about making deals with English guys or French guys or anybody who can help you make money. So what's interesting is, and it would be a good question to ask maybe in your research, is if you read the correspondence of a later 18th century person of Dutch heritage, how much memory do they preserve of their Dutch roots? That'd be interesting to explore, I think.
Yep. Okay, so we're moving chronologically a little bit. So let's just keep going. 19th century. And we mentioned earlier your article, Present at the Creation.
Right.
And that was about, it was generally about Broadhead, right? Broadheads.
I think he's in there. I think there's some other
Callahan.
And other people who revivified the Dutch. I think you would mention in the 19th century, you have the St. Nicholas Society formed, the Holland Society formed. I think by the late 19th century, people of Dutch ancestry who are probably fairly privileged people and have the time to do this, fit into a larger sort of movement of descendants of the original pioneers, and form these genealogical and heritage societies in the face of immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. So I think Holland Society, I think, is formed in the mid-1880s. And they have,
Holland Dames.
Those people are celebrating their Dutch heritage. They still do this. And I am an honorary fellow of the Holland Society of New York and proud of it. And I've spoken to them and they've been very good to me. And they take trips to the homeland and all of that stuff to just say, we're great, we're Dutch, but of course we're proud Americans as well. The question is, what should we make of that? I mean, there's plenty of evidence of the more privileged descendants of the Dutch joining these societies and creating memorabilia that said, oh, of course we're Dutch. But what is that really telling us about their view of their ancestors' behavior in the past? I mean, as you know, I've written a lot about the Dutch and slavery, and it's certainly mentioned in this book and other books. Until fairly recently, the last several decades, that was sort of a taboo topic because the Dutch were major players in the Dutch West India Company in slavery. Wim Kloster's recent book, The Dutch Moment, talks a lot about that. Scholars in the Netherlands are like, yeah, that's part of our historical memory and it ain't so great. I argued in an article or an essay in a book called something about merging the two streams of narrative in New Netherland, about here come all the brave European pioneers, mostly Dutch, but some other people. And then this sort of totally different narrative about here come the slaves. Why not just create one narrative of migration to New Netherland, voluntary and involuntary, perhaps, or some formulation that says these are people. Some were forced to come against their will. And you know, the early people of African descent in New Amsterdam actually had a good deal of latitude, and some of them gain their freedom. So it's not a totally horrific story. Things actually go downhill for African people in the English period.
Yep.
But I think the connection between the Dutch and the slave trade, which has now been examined in great depth and in much, much more extensive scholarly way than I have, shouldn't be ignored. It's part of the memory. But if you ask those Holland Society guys 100 years ago, like, what? Who are they? You know, and any other ethnic society, too. So when it wasn't just picking on the Dutch.
Yeah.
The Dutch were equally guilty.
Okay. Let me think. So let's end it with a really broad question. You've already started to get into kind of where New Netherland scholarship is going a little bit. Where the kind of it's going more toward the, well, you said combining those two streams, kind of telling this combined story instead of keeping them separated.
Well, I think that would be one direction in which progress could be made. Clearly, the Atlantic world framework, or even a global framework for situating the Dutch primarily in the 17th century, but now into the 18th century as well, is one direction that we're moving in, and I think that's good. So we're getting rid of this provincial, the Dutch are sort of winter oddballs who are there for about 40 years and they just leave. That's ridiculous. I mean, then of course I'm always a big exponent or a person in favor of an inclusive history. So let's write about communities. And let's write about everybody in those communities. Now, my work is centered largely on New Amsterdam and New York City, and there's plenty of scholarship on Albany and so on. But there are ways that I think we could write a more inclusive history, maybe through the lens of memory, which is I know what you're working on, but to not only just say, oh yes, you know, we had slaves or we had Native American, or, you know, but to see how those groups actually interacted on the ground in the moment. I'm all for microcosms as being very revealing and something we talked about before, the micro-sociology of power. Well, history is, you know, for centuries been dominated by the big guys. And there's nothing wrong with studying the big guys in depth. You said, why would anybody want to write something about George Washington now?
Yeah.
Actually, I really like to read about George Washington. I just finished reading a book about the enslaved woman, Ona Judge, she was actually Martha Washington's personal slave. And when they moved up to the first White House in Philadelphia, she escaped and ran off to New Hampshire and became a free woman. Can't remember the title of the book. It's just a brand new book. And I had read that story before in several other books, but it was told pretty much from the perspective of the enslaved people in Washington's household. And it really opened my eyes in some of the instances of how you can really see something with fresh eyes if you ask the right, or not necessarily the right questions, but just new questions.
Yeah.
And so I think as we move along in New Netherland studies, I think other scholars should explore the post-New Netherland period in greater detail in places like Albany or other communities, perhaps in what becomes Brooklyn. What actually happened in the 18th century? You still have tons of Dutch farmers all over the place, and a lot of them have enslaved Africans, and then they're bordered by English communities. What is actually going on the ground in terms of interactions and competitions for cultural authority? I think that might be another direction.
Sounds great, Joyce. Let's end it there.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.